court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. I'll call the third case for the day, State versus DeLapp. Are you ready to proceed, Counselor? Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Herbert, and I represent the defendant appellate petitioner in this case, Stephen DeLapp. Good afternoon. There's a few topics that I'd like to discuss today. First, I'd like to talk about the fact that the officers in this case, although they were acting in hot pursuit of Mr. DeLapp, they did not have a compelling need or urgency that was the basis for their warrantless entry into his residence at 110 Milwaukee Street. Second, I'd like to discuss that when we consider the totality of the circumstances, I think we would have to conclude, based on that consideration, that the officer's warrantless entry in this case into the premises at 110 Milwaukee Street. And finally, although the officers did have active warrants for the arrest of Mr. DeLapp, under the circumstances of this case, I do not believe that the warrants authorized them to enter his residence for the purpose of arresting him.
What did they authorize him to do? Arrest him, but he had to come outside to get arrested?
Well, I think that there is a principle that in some instances, arrest warrants do allow the police to go into the subject's residence in order to effectuate the arrest. But what I'm saying is that in this particular case, the specific circumstances preclude application of that rule.
What are the specific circumstances that precluded the application of the rule?
In order for that rule from Payton to apply, and as that has been applied by this court in cases such as Kuiper, the officers must have probable cause to believe that the suspect resides at the premises and also is present at the premises at the time. I think both of those circumstances are in question in this particular case. I don't believe they had probable cause to believe he was actually present at the time, and I don't think they had probable cause to believe that he lived there based on the information that they had.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
And so while we discuss these topics, I'd like to keep a few just basic principles in mind. The first one is that the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness, and we determine reasonableness by considering the totality of the circumstances. A warrantless entry into a home is presumptively unreasonable, and the burden is on the state to overcome that presumption of unreasonableness and to demonstrate that the actions of the officers were lawful.
Counsel, you just stated the Kuiper test about the that the defendant resides at the location and is present at the time. The facts to me sure indicate presence at the time.
I understand. I mean, and so he was definitely present at the time. But the question is whether the officers had probable cause to believe he was present at the time before the incident occurred. And so I think that based on the information that they had available to them, they did not have that level of probable cause, because I think both officers testified at the motion hearing, one more than the other. And so I think it was Sergeant Willman who provided the bulk of the testimony. And what we learned from that is they had some information that he was living at this residence. Mm-hmm. The information, some of it was dated, some of it may have been less dated, but it was somewhat generic and vague. When they went to the residence to look for him, it doesn't appear that they knew what he looked like based on such as a photograph. So I don't think they were able to recognize him on sight. They had a pretty generic description that it was a white male aged 25 to 30. But it was also, they went to the premises, it was early September, around 9 p.m. It was dark enough so that the officers needed to use their flashlights. And so I think when you combine the darkness, the distance between where they first observed him, and the generic description, I don't think that when they got there and they saw this individual that they had probable cause to believe that that's the guy we're looking for.
Well, counsel, perhaps we could look at it just a little bit differently. So they were there because they had reason to believe he lived at 110 Milwaukee Street, right?
I'm sorry, could you?
The police were there because they had information that indicated that he lived at 110 Milwaukee Street.
Right.
So whether that information was a week old or a month old, that's the information that they have. So they go there, they see somebody that at least matches the description that they have. The person runs, they tell him to stop, he doesn't, and what does he do? He goes into 110 Milwaukee Street. Well, how much more do you want the police to have to have probable cause to believe that they're chasing Mr. Delap into his residence?
Well, I think that the officers testified that they really weren't sure. For example, when they first got to the premises, they observed another individual. There was a car parked in the street, and another individual was standing by the car. And the officers talked amongst themselves as to whether that particular person might be Mr. Delap. They decided it wasn't. And yes, when Mr. Delap saw the officers, he turned. When they shouted for him to stop, he ran. So I think it would be a reasonable inference to draw that that person might be Mr. Delap, given his propensity to flee, as they had learned from their other information. I guess what I'm saying is that I don't think that probable cause can be based merely on or solely on a reasonable inference.
Well, it's more, but they've got that, plus they were at 110 Milwaukee Street, where they were expecting to find him.
Well, I think that I'm not sure they were expecting to find him there when they went there on that particular day. I don't think they had any, according to the testimony in the record, they didn't have any suggestion that, for example, someone had called or someone had let them know that he's there right now or that he's going to be there at a certain time. So I do think there's a difference between probable cause that he lives there and probable cause that he's there right now. He could have been living there but not present at the time. And I think when you're talking about going into a residence to arrest someone on a warrant, I think it is required that they have probable cause to believe that he is there right now. And so I think there's a footnote in the Kuiper case that suggests that probable cause has to be based on more than just an inference, even if the inference is reasonable. And in this case, I think that's all they had. At one point, the officer was asked, why did you think the guy who ran was Delap and the guy who was standing in the street by the car was not? And the officer said, because you ran. And so I think they didn't really have the opportunity or the capability to recognize him on site. They didn't have any other independent information that he was actually there that night. And so,
but Counselor, at the moment that he ran, and he ran into 110, isn't that the point at which they have to have the requisite standard of proof? They don't have to have it when they walk up the street. They have to have it at the moment they go into his house after him, correct?
Exactly.
Okay. So didn't he help by what he did provide the necessary standard of proof for them to follow him in the house?
I think he provided them with a basis to draw a reasonable inference that he was the person that they were looking for. But I don't think that a reasonable inference standing alone is enough for probable cause. And I think that footnote in the Kuiper case, it's not completely on point, but it does suggest that drawing a reasonable inference about something and reaching a reasonable conclusion about something does not mean that we have probable cause as to that something. And so without more information, without some solid information other than we're looking for a guy who ran in the past, that guy ran, he must be the guy that we're looking for. I think that is a reasonable inference, but it's not sufficient to establish probable cause. And okay. So I think that's why the Payton rule, at least on one point, I think is not applicable to this case. And it's interesting because it appears from the motion hearing that that's how the case kind of started. It appears from the motion hearing that the judge was inclined to find that the officers were entitled to go into that residence to arrest him on these warrants.
You say that's not enough. It's dark, as you notice, September, late at night, that the officers are using flashlights. What more would they have needed?
Well, they could have perhaps had just some independent corroboration that he was there. Or they could have maybe asked the guy who was standing in the street if DLAP lives here. Or something, some other contemporaneous solid information other
than...
Let me
refine my question to make it closer to what we have. What more would they have needed, to, in your opinion? You're using a phrase, reasonable inference. What is the bare minimum they would have needed to cross the threshold into from reasonable inference to probable cause? So far, I've heard you use that phrase. I didn't count, but it's over half a dozen times. And every time you've used it, it's a question has been forming, and it's finally crystallized. And I'm thinking to myself, what's the distinction he's trying to make between reasonable inference and probable cause? And so as it relates to this case, what do you think would have brought these officers over the hump from reasonable inference to probable cause?
Well, I think some kind of solid fact information, for example, from someone who knows that he lives there and is present at the time. I think there were other cases where they had information specifically from an individual that led the officers to believe that a person whom they were looking for was going to be at a specific place at a specific time.
So the information that he's living at 110, they get close to 110, the officer testifies he's not 100% sure he's at 110, but only because of the sequential numbers of the up and down nature of the residences. But they know they're close. They see the two guys. They call out the name. The one starts bolting. 4-1-10. That's not probable cause. That's not what a common sense, you know, I'll paraphrase the definition, that probable cause is not a scientific term. It's a common sense determination that people use in their everyday, ordinary life, that something is more probable than not. That's not probably, Mr. Dela.
I think in this case it's more of a possibility, just based on the fact that, and I don't think they called out his name. I think they did say stop, but the officers testified that they weren't sure if that was the person that they were chasing, or if the person that they had observed originally, who ended up fleeing, was actually Mr. Dela. And since they didn't have a very good description of him, and I think that would be another factor that would support probable cause, is if they had, for example, a good description of him, or had seen a photograph so they could recognize him on sight. And even in the dark, as they got closer, they may have been able to recognize him. But when they engaged in the pursuit, the only reason that they had to think that he's the guy they're looking for is because he ran and the other guy didn't. That's what the officer said.
After he instructs him to stop. You're right. He didn't call out the name. The testimony is they told him to stop.
And I think it's... As I said, I think it's reasonable, but I think that Mr. Dela is not the only person who would run from the police.
You think it's reasonable, but it's not probable.
That's correct.
Okay.
I think that's a distinction that is relevant and it has to be made.
Thank you.
Counsel, you say at page 35 of your brief, had the officers taken the time to obtain a warrant that authorized them to enter the residence, Mr. Dela would not have defeated their plans to arrest him. Are you saying the officers would have prevailed because of superior force or because Mr. Dela would surrender himself?
Well, I think I wouldn't discount the possibility of surrender. I think what I'm getting at in that is there was no indication in the record that, or in the testimony of the officers, that they had a concern about him escaping. And so I think we have to keep in mind that when there's a warrantless entry, there's a presumption of unreasonableness, and the state has the burden of rebutting that. And so I think the burden is on the state to show that the actions were reasonable.
Okay, and yes, so, but hang on a second, though. I just wanted to I just wanted to follow that reasoning that you had there, that Mr. Delap would not have defeated their plans to arrest him. So it appears that he was trying to do that very thing. Yes?
I would say, I think he was acting more on impulse than he was acting on a plan that was sent to him, that if he was able to get through that front door and get it closed, that somehow he was going to escape. I think he ran on impulse, and I think that's partly maybe why they pursued him.
Do we have any evidence that this was just an impulsive thing, and that once the impulse had subsided, his reason would have suggested that he would have walked out the door and surrendered to the police?
Well, I don't think we should discount that, because I think one thing that may have happened would be, I think that there is not an incentive to flee. And one of the reasons why I don't think there's an incentive to flee is because if you get caught, you're going to end up getting charged with an additional offense like obstructing.
Well, but counsel, isn't the answer to Justice Kelly's question yes, in the form of testimony at the hearing?
Well, I think that I wouldn't discount the possibility that however much time it would have taken to get a warrant, during that period of time, if they would have said, they may have been able to convince him to surrender just by saying, look,
excuse me, counsel, I'm talking about your answer to Justice Kelly when you posited that Mr. Delap ran on impulse, and then Justice Kelly asked you about, well, do we have any evidence about whether he ran on impulse? And my eye is drawn to his testimony. I suspected that someone was chasing me. Question. Okay, so the reason why you were running was to get away from a police officer. Answer. I suppose. Question. It's a yes or no question. Answer. Sure. Question. Okay, because you didn't want to be arrested on the warrant and taken to jail. Answer. That is correct. Question. All right. And then so you essentially, what you did is you retreated into a private place. Is that fair to say? Answer. That's fair to say. All right. And you tried to close the door on the officer. Answer. Yes. I mean, is that what you're referring to as an impulse?
Well, I think obviously he was motivated by a desire to avoid being arrested. But I don't think that, but I think that it's possible that if he had been offered the possibility to, say, surrender and not face the additional charge of obstructing, that once things calmed down a bit, I think it's possible that he might have gone ahead and surrendered. If he knows that he's not going to avoid the arrest, even though he might have been able to get into the residence.
And one of the things I forgot to include when I was going by memory, as I am now, about probable cause, and I suppose of the two of us, I should have caught it, is based on the totality of the circumstances, what should a reasonable police officer have expected? Should we expect a reasonable police officer to have believed at the time? And this officer had been informed of Mr. Delap's proclivity for running from the police when confronted by police, right?
That's correct.
So this was when the officers instructed the individual who turned out to be Mr. Delap to stop, and Mr. Delap didn't stop. That would have been in conformity with what these police officers were expecting.
Yes.
Thank you.
So it sounds to me like the possibility that Mr. Delap would have surrendered himself, or that there would be reason to believe he might, is actually diminished in comparison with the norm. The officers knew that Mr. Delap had actually successfully fled in prior instances. They knew that they resisted officers and engaged in assaultive behavior. So why should we have any reason to believe that in this instance Mr. Delap would be attacked by a good conscience and reason and walk out the door and surrender himself?
Well, I think in the instances where he had fled successfully, the key distinction is that he didn't flee into his home or into an enclosed structure. I think in both instances he ran into the woods at night. And so that was, I think, what was allowed him to defeat the arrest. And I think that's what this case presents as a difference in compared to those instances, where instead of fleeing into the mist, so to speak, he fled into an enclosed structure from which there was realistically no escape.
That's,
and so I think maybe if he was offered the choice between surrendering and not facing new charges, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people would take that deal and say, I would rather surrender to the warrants, the arrest that I know is going to happen, and avoid more charges for obstructing and possibly more jail time.
Right. So, but as the police were looking at that, wouldn't it be more reasonable for them to expect that given the fact that he had fled into a box end canyon, that he might turn violent as he had before?
Well, I'm not sure what the basis was for them to believe that he would turn violent. I understand that they had received some information that he had been violent or had resisted violently in the past, but I don't think they had any specifics as to the details of those instances. And so I think certainly they had a reason to believe that he might resist or he might resist with violence or at least some degree of force. But I also think that just in terms of what they could have done differently, which I think was part of the question, is why not try to defuse the situation? I think that's part of what we're talking about here is if a person has tendencies to resist and do so in a violent manner, maybe it would be better to not engage in that, and maybe it would be better to wait and try to obtain a warrant to enter the premises and let him know that that's what we're doing. And
so
that
and that's a good point. You know, it's always better to defuse than the opposite. But did the police perhaps know whether there was anyone else in the residence at the time?
I think the record would indicate that they didn't know either way. I don't think they really had enough information to make any decisions about who may or may not have been there.
Yeah. And did they know whether he might have a cache of arms in this residence?
I don't think they had any basis to think he had ever used a weapon in any of his prior cases.
But they didn't know whether or not he had a cache of arms in the residence. Fair?
No, they didn't know for sure.
Okay. Did they know whether he would be able to set up an ambush inside the residence if they came in after him?
I think they had no reason to think he did. They didn't have any base. I don't think they had any concrete information on either point, but they certainly didn't have any reason to think that he was going to ambush them with weapons based on his record of previously resisting.
Well, he's fled. He's obstructed and engaged in assaultive behavior. Is there any reason, was it reasonable for the police to consider such things? The chance of injury to others who might be in there, maybe a hostage situation, maybe setting up an ambush where they get the warrant and then come in after him? Could they reasonably consider those things?
I don't think the records suggest that they considered those things. I think those are hypothetical concerns, but I don't think the record indicates that they actually did consider those things. And if they had considered those things and had concerns about those things, I think that would be an independent justification, like exigent circumstances that might allow them to do that.
Right. So when we review these situations, what we do is we look at what a reasonable officer would do, right? And so we can look at the hypotheticals. So would these, hypothetically speaking, would these be reasonable considerations for which to account in deciding whether to go in immediately or allow the person to go in and set up whatever ambushes or situations of force that he might choose to enact?
Well, I think the reasonableness of the hypothetical concern would be based on what information they had, if any, that would kind of give credence to that. So if they had learned, for example, that Mr. Delap had used weapons in the past, or if they even thought that this is actually his permanent residence as opposed to a place where he's crashing for a period of time, perhaps those concrete circumstances might have made those hypothetical concerns reasonable. But without some information to suggest that those were anything more than hypothetical concerns, I don't think that they were reasonable in this case because they weren't based on any objective facts. And the officers in their motion hearing testimony never testified that they were concerned about that at all.
So you wouldn't think the court can render an opinion based on these reasonable hypotheticals?
I don't think that, well, if it's a reason, if they had a reasonable basis for such a concern, I think that would change the calculus.
But that reasonable basis would have to be in the record.
I think it would have to be a fact that's in the record.
Counsel, are you advocating that Payton applies only to felony offenses?
I'm not. No. But I think for Payton to apply, there is an interesting point that seems to have been made at the end of that case in terms of what kinds of warrants are actually covered. And I think there's some language in there that talks about when a judicial officer has been convinced that a person has committed a crime and issued a warrant for that person's arrest. And I think that kind of a warrant is distinguishable from, say, a warrant, a probation and parole warrant for violating a rule. Or
other jurisdictions have been applying it to misdemeanors, applying it. The Ninth Circuit applied it to an arrest warrant for failure to appear, I think, if I recall correctly.
And that may be. But I know that in the Wisconsin cases, it doesn't seem as if that actual issue has been raised or addressed in terms of what kinds of warrants are covered by Payton. And again, I think since we don't have the warrants as part of the record, we don't know what they are actually for. We know that Sergeant Willman testified that one was a probation and parole felony warrant, and I see that the red light has come on.
Yeah, you can finish your thought.
So I think that they had some vague notions about what the warrants were for, but we don't know that these warrants were not for probation or supervision rules violation or for missing a pretrial conference in a pending Jefferson County case.
Yeah, I may have misread the record, but I thought the testimony was that one was a probation hold and the other was a felony warrant.
I think it could be a felony warrant without being based on probable cause of a commission of a crime. For example, if a person missed court in a pending felony case, they would be subject to a felony warrant even though they hadn't committed a new crime.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I am Jennifer McNamee, and I represent the State in this appeal.
Ms. McNamee, would you be kind enough to raise that podium just a little bit? You know there's a button on the inside panel to your right. There is a button, and if you can't, the Deputy Marshal will be gracious enough to help you find it.
This court should affirm under either of the two theories offered by the state. First, under Payton versus New York, the officers could enter the residence located at 110 Milwaukee Street to arrest DeLapp because they had arrest warrants and reason to believe that DeLapp lived there and was currently inside the residence at the time of execution of the warrants.
Counsel, what do you say to Mr. Herbert's suggestion that the police didn't know that the person they were chasing was Mr. DeLapp?
Your Honor, I would disagree with opposing counsel's suggestion that the officers didn't know. I think here the officers had at least three different sets of facts that led them to reasonably believe that the person that they were chasing into the residence was Mr. DeLapp. First, the person in the driveway fit Mr. DeLapp's general description. Second, the person was in the area. In fact, he was in the driveway of the residence where the officers were attempting to execute the warrants. And third, the person that they were arresting was a known fleer. He had fled on two previous occasions. And the person in the driveway, who fit the general description and was in the area, responded in this case by fleeing from the officers. I think that those three sets of facts and circumstances give the officers in this case, at the very least, reason to believe that the person that they were chasing into the residence was Mr. DeLapp.
And by reason to believe, you mean probable cause?
Your Honor, in State versus Kuiper, this court did equate the reason to believe standard with probable cause, and that is likely due to the fact that in Kuiper, both the state and the defense agreed that the two could be equated. There is currently a circuit split on the issue, but because under either the reason to believe or the probable cause standard, the facts here meet either of those two standards, the court doesn't have to take a firm position in this case on whether or not reason to believe should actually be equated with probable cause, because under either standard, the facts are met. In Payton, as this court knows...
Ms. McNamee, one of the arguments your opposing counsel raised in regard to the concept of running away, fleeing from officers, is that this occasion did not fit within his modus operandi. He used a colorful phrase, and it should have stuck with me with more clarity, something about he didn't disappear into the mists of the fog or mists of the forest. Now, the approach of St. Patrick's Day notwithstanding, and I don't think he's a leprechaun, but this time he went into a house. What is your response to that?
Your Honor, my response to that would be that the particularities of where Mr. Delap fled to don't take away from the fact that Mr. Delap was known to the police as being a fleer. Now, the reason why Mr. Delap may not have fled into the residence on the two prior occasions is because those were traffic stops. And so
one, I believe, memory stands, occurred in a rural area at a four-way stop in the middle of the woods, and I don't recall anything about any houses being present.
That's correct, Your Honor. The record does not indicate that Mr. Delap was close to his residence at the time that he fled from the two earlier traffic stops. What it demonstrates is that when given the opportunity, Mr. Delap will try to flee from officers in this case in order to avoid arrest. And Mr. Delap's testimony at the suppression hearing, and in addition, the statements that he made, which were recorded on the ICOP camera, confirm in this case that Mr. Delap was running away from the officers, even though they had told him to stop and even though they had identified themselves, because he didn't want to be arrested on the warrants and taken to jail.
Which time was this?
That
you're referring to that was caught on the camera?
This incident, Your Honor, was caught on camera. There's a footnote in the state's brief that references the CD on the ICOP camera. It's a part of the record, although it doesn't include a record number. And near the end of the conversation that is caught in the recording, you can hear Mr. Delap say that he heard the officers tell him to stop. He references knowing that they were officers and that he didn't want to be arrested.
Please proceed.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll continue discussing Payton only because it seems like this court is sort of most interested in Payton, and I would agree that Payton offers the narrowest grounds for affirmance in this case because this is not a warrantless entry case. This is a case where the officers, through their due diligence, looked up information, discovered that Delap had two outstanding arrest warrants, one of which was a felony warrant, the other of which was a probation and parole warrant, and based on that information, proceeded to the residence that they believed was Mr. Delap's on good facts and attempted to execute the warrant in this case. And I'll just briefly go through the facts that I think gave them reason to believe. I'll reference it from here on out as probable cause, since, like I said earlier, the court doesn't have to specifically set a standard here as it's met under either. The facts here were that the officers had received information from Deputy Gellenbeck through his investigation that Delap was living at 110 Milwaukee Street. A court of appeals case, Blanco, has said that phrases like staying with and living with are consistent with residing and are therefore sufficient to support an officer's belief that the suspect has resided at that location.
Is there anything in the record that indicates this was not his address?
No, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record that would indicate it's not his address. The only...
I mean, everyone keeps talking about Kuiper, but part of Kuiper is it was someone saying, hey, you're going into my home to arrest this third party. That's a little different scenario, don't you think, than going to your own home to be going to that person, that potential defendant's own home to arrest that defendant on an existent two, actually, arrest warrants.
That's true, Your Honor. I wouldn't go so far as to say that the record establishes that this is DeLapp's primary home. DeLapp contests that at the suppression hearing, although he does admit to it being his temporary residence. And I would agree, this is not a Kuiper case. In this case, the officers had much more information that they didn't, than they did in Kuiper, where the only information they really had there was that the person could have been found there with 6 weeks earlier, or almost a month earlier.
Talk to me about limits. What are the limits on law enforcement executing valid arrest warrants?
Sure, Your Honor. The limits as set under Payton are that the officers need to have probable cause to believe that the suspect that they're executing the warrant on resides in the residence, and that the suspect is present at the time of entry. And those are really the two qualifications that Payton puts on officers when they're trying to execute arrest warrants in the home. And in addition to that, I would say that because we're operating under the Fourth Amendment, the execution, of course, would need to be reasonable. And all three of those things are met in this case. So first, we know that Mr. DeLapp resided in this residence for one of the reasons I've already given, which is that Deputy Gallenbeck had received information that he was living there. The second piece of information is the teletype correspondence from Walworth County, which listed 110 Milwaukee Street as his residence, and that information really corroborated the information that Deputy Gallenbeck had discovered earlier through his investigation. The third is that the officers...
Let me ask you this. If you took out... Go ahead and finish third, and then I have my question.
There's actually two left. So
okay.
So the third is that the officers found DeLapp in the driveway of the residence.
But they really didn't know that was him for sure.
They testified that they weren't 100% certain that it was Mr. DeLapp, although probable cause would not require them to be 100% certain. But they did believe, and I think reasonably for the reasons I gave earlier, that that person was DeLapp. And so then the fourth reason that they believe he resided there is because he ran towards as opposed to away from that residence. He ran back into 110. And so I think those four facts taken together as a whole, when you're looking at the totality of the circumstances, gave the officers probable cause to believe that he lived there.
Okay. So let's just say the officers, without any of those things other than having an arrest warrant for this person and knowing this to be their residence, what can an officer do without the person being in the driveway, without any of the other facts? What can an officer do if they believe this is the person's residence or know that's the person's residence and they have valid arrest warrants?
Sure. So under Payton, the officers could approach the home and they would knock on the door and they would ask if anybody's home. If they have then information to believe that the suspect that they're looking for is present within the home at that time while they're trying to execute the warrants, the officers can enter the home. If they don't have information that would give them probable cause to believe the resident that the suspect is present within at that moment of execution, then they would not enter the home. And so here, they knew that DeLapp was present at the time of entry because they watched him enter the home. I just don't think that there's any sort of reasonable argument to the contrary here under these facts because the officers watched him enter the home in this case, so they knew that he was present within at the time of entry. And now in Payton, the information that gives an officer probable cause to believe that a person is present, it doesn't necessarily have to be a lot. In Payton, it was just that there was music emanating from the home. And usually if there's music emanating, somebody's inside the home. So it doesn't have to be sort of an enormous consideration of circumstances for that element of Payton to be satisfied.
So if somebody doesn't answer the door and they think he's inside and this is the residence that's listed for him and they believe that he's in there, can they just break down the door and arrest him?
Your Honor, I wouldn't say that the officers could break down the door. I think there might be more reasonable means for entering the home at that point. But yes, if they have probable cause to believe that a person is present inside the home at the time of execution, they can enter the home.
So might it actually be more reasonable to pursue arresting him on the warrant this way without resorting to those more extraordinary measures?
It was definitely reasonable for the officers to give chase to DeLapp under these circumstances. Namely because DeLapp is, or he was known to be a frequent fleer by the police, and the officers knew, based on the warrant returns, that he had violent tendencies and a history of resisting and assaulting police officers. So, yes, it was very reasonable for the officers here to give chase in order to finish the execution of those warrants.
Yeah, I could see an argument that someone would say, this was not reasonable. They knew that was me. They knew I ran into the house. They didn't pursue me then. They waited until the middle of the night and then decided to break down the door. You know, that might be unreasonable, right?
It could be unreasonable, Your Honor. Yes.
That might be a more persuasive argument as to what is and is not a reasonable way to execute a warrant. But I'm trying to figure out how this is even... Kuiper, I don't think, is really a fit. You're going to have to work with me a little more on that, because that's someone else.
Kuiper is definitely not a fit in this case, Your Honor. This case is a Payton case. It's a Blanco case. The officers here meet the criteria under Payton. They have much more information than the officers possessed, than the officers in Kuiper did. It's a completely different case than a Kuiper case, just on the facts alone. Yes. And in Kuiper, the warrant... It wasn't a felony warrant. It may not have even been a criminal warrant. I think the warrant in that case was for failure to pay a $55 fine. And so this case, it's just a much stronger
These
case
are criminal
than a Kuiper
warrants.
Case.
The not, record for not for forfeitures.
The record indicates that one of the warrants was a probation and parole warrant and that the other warrant was a felony arrest warrant. And unfortunately, the warrants are not included in the record, but those are the pieces of information that we have about the warrants.
Is there anything about Payton that is not on point?
No, Your Honor. I wouldn't say so. We have a felony arrest warrant in this case. The officers have probable cause to believe that this is DeLapp's residence. They have probable cause to believe that he's present inside at the time of execution. This case fits the facts of Payton, which is why Payton provides the narrowest grounds for affirmance in this case.
Counsel, if the court does apply Payton in accordance with your argument, is there any good reason for the court to address the hot pursuit aspect of the case?
Your Honor, I don't believe it would be, I don't think the court should address hot pursuit in this case, only because we have warrants in this case. And hot pursuit and exigent circumstances are really left for situations that are warrantless entries, and this is not a warrantless entry. And so although hot pursuit does provide an alternative basis for affirmance in this case, it's much better to put this case where it belongs, which is in Payton, because the officers have arrest warrants. Unless the court has any further questions.
Ms. McAmey, you were responding to a question from Justice Ziegler. It was one of, I think it was the second question that she asked, and it had to do with the officer's knowledge that it was Mr. DeLapp who he was chasing. And you correctly recited the answers. I'm talking about I'm having a tough time finding his name. The one who was not Sergeant Willman.
Oh, Deputy Wass?
And
or Deputy Gallenbeck?
The one who testified that, and it was Mr. DeLapp himself who conducted the cross-examination, who did, all things considered, an effective job. And on page 39 of the blue brief, asked the question at line 14. Again, I'll ask, did you know it was Stephen DeLapp? Again, this is Stephen DeLapp asking the questions. Did you know it was Stephen DeLapp when you pursued that individual for sure? Answer, not 100% no. This is where what I assume the lack of formal legal training shows. No further questions. And in preceding questions, Mr. DeLapp had revealed through questioning the witness that the only way that the pursuing officer had to know or had an idea that it was Mr. DeLapp was through the general description as given by the warrant from Walworth County, the description from Walworth County, and by the instruction to stop and then the running in response. So, while he says not 100%, it doesn't seem to be based on anything in terms of any personal knowledge. I know that is Stephen Belap. It's all based on the Walworth County information as well as what he observed on the night of the arrest. Does that comport with your understanding as well?
Yes, Your Honor, it does.
Okay. Okay. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't missing anything.
No, that's the exact same way as the state reads the record, Your Honor, yes.
All right.
Unless this court has any further questions, the state will simply rest on its brief. And although we have spent a majority of our time discussing the Peyton issue, hot pursuit would provide an alternative grounds for affirmance in this case, and the state would simply rest on the hot pursuit arguments that it made in its brief should this court decide this is a hot pursuit case.
Thank you. I guess I have a question. As I have read Peyton and the cases applying Peyton, it seems to me that part of the application of Peyton is to look at the underlying offense for which they want this guy.
Your Honor, I would disagree with that reading of Peyton. And if what Your Honor is referring to here is that this is a jailable offense in this case as opposed to a larger offense.
Right.
I don't think that the Supreme Court's jurisprudence has limited Peyton to applying solely to major offenses, and I would simply reference the court's attention to Illinois versus MacArthur and also to Stanton versus Sims, where the Supreme Court explains that what is important in looking at in cases is more the penalty for the offense than it is the nature of the offense.
Say that to me again and explain it more fully.
Sure. So first, I should be clear that when we're talking about Peyton,
yes.
The question sometimes...
is entering a house with an arrest warrant.
With an arrest warrant, yes, Your Honor. Peyton described it in terms of it being a felony warrant. There's an open question sort of among the circuit courts as to whether or not Peyton should apply to lesser warrants, such as misdemeanor warrants, or bench warrants, some forms of civil warrants. Some courts have answered yes, and some courts have answered no. This court has not addressed that question, although the court need not reach it here because there was a felony warrant in this
right.
case. Thank you.
Let me begin by addressing the point on Kuiper. And so I would agree that Kuiper does not govern this case in terms of the facts. That was a case where the officers did not have probable cause to believe the suspect lived at the residence. And so the other line of cases does apply. But as far as the Blanco case, I think it does help us to take a look at that case because Blanco was a case where the officers had considerably more information as to where the person was, not just where they were living, but where they actually were at the time. I think in Blanco, the officers carried photographs with them to the place that they had come to search for the guy. They showed the photographs to the landlord and some neighbors, and they got confirmation that not only does he live there, but that he actually is there. And they got further confirmation that he'd been seen standing outside smoking a cigarette right before that. And so I think that Blanco is an interesting case, and I think it does sort of cut against the argument that if he ran, it must be him because he's run before. I think Blanco demonstrates that there's a lot more concrete information that could have been obtained or at least potentially could have helped the officers establish a probable cause. The officers in this case did not bring photographs or talk to any witnesses, and no one told them that Mr. DeLapp had just been seen there, you know, relatively soon. And as far as whether that's a reasonable distinction to make, I think the court in the lower court, at the end of the motion hearing, made that distinction. The court started off, I think, fairly on board with the idea that this is a Peyton case and that the officers had everything they needed. I think as time went on and the uncertainty of the information was developed at the hearing, the court moved back from that. And at a certain point, the state asked if the court was going to make a finding on that issue at the end of the hearing, and the court said no. And then subsequently, when the court issued its decision, the court did not really even address the Peyton argument. It completely focused on the hot pursuit argument. And so I think that this is a hot pursuit case. And I think that although hot pursuit does stand alone as an exigent circumstance, I don't think that the totality of the circumstances in this case justify a warrantless entry. And there was no warrant to enter 110 Milwaukee Street. So I think it is a warrantless entry case because they didn't have a warrant to enter the premises that they entered. I don't think they had any sort of need or urgency to do so. The entry was not limited as it was in the Weber case. They used force. They opened a door that was being pushed from the other side. One officer took his taser out and pointed it at Mr. Delap to get him to comply. In terms of, so I don't think that, I don't think they had the requisite level of urgency or necessity that is required for a warrantless entry, particularly when the state bears the burden of overcoming the presumption that warrantless entries are inherently unreasonable.
Is this a warrantless entry?
No. It's a warrantless entry into the house, but a warrant
right.
for the arrest. As I understand the case, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is that they had a warrant to arrest Mr. Delap. They did not have a warrant that said you can go into 110 Milwaukee Street. And so then whether Peyton applies, I think it's more than just a question of whether it's a felony warrant or a misdemeanor warrant. And as I said before, a felony arrest warrant could be the kind of a warrant issued for missing court. And there's nothing in the Peyton case, that, as far as I can tell, that would indicate that is the kind of a warrant that would justify going into a residence, whether it be the person's own residence or if they happen to be living with other people. I think there is a Fourth Amendment issue as to the fact that there is a line drawn at that door. And if the officers are going to engage in a trespass, I think they need more concrete information than the information that they had. And I think they need to make sure that the warrants they're going to try to effectuate are consistent with the type of warrants that were discussed in Peyton. So I think it is a significant difference as to whether a judge has issued a warrant because there's been probable cause that someone has committed a new crime or a crime versus missing court or a probation and parole warrant for a rules violation. And so I think based on that, I would suggest that Peyton doesn't apply, particularly given the disparity between the kind of information the officers had in this case.
When the police tell a fleeing citizen, a running citizen, to stop, does the citizen have a duty to stop?
Well, I think it's a crime if he doesn't stop, if he knows that the officers are telling him to stop.
All right. So would a reasonable police officer's suspicions be aroused if the fleeing citizen did not stop after receiving that command?
I guess it depends on what suspicions of what. I mean, certainly it would be an indication that the person is engaged in criminal activity by virtue of the fact that they have engaged in at least the beginnings of an obstructing offense. And
Fair enough.
That my time is over, so thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, and thank you both for fine arguments and helpful briefs. The court is going to adjourn, and we will meet in closed conference at 3:00. We are adjourned.